good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 604 of Unwelcome Guests, Occupy the Past. I'm Robin Upton, and this week on the show, our main focus is direct action movements of the 20th century. We've got an hour and a bit by Jim Douglas about his book Gandhi and the Unspeakable, but we're going to start with a few minutes from Chris Hedges speaking about a column he wrote in Truthdig a couple of months back.
Your column this week on Truthdig was about the future of the Occupy movement. In fact, you've written a great deal about the Occupy movement. Why is that?
Well, I have, in the last few books, come to the conclusion that the political system doesn't work, at least for ordinary working men and women, that we've undergone a kind of corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, and that the only mechanisms we have left to challenge formal structures of power are acts of civil disobedience. And I have carried out acts of civil disobedience with Veterans for Peace and other groups even before the rise of Occupy. But Occupy articulated something that I thought was extremely important, and in a way that I could embrace. In the last few weeks, I've been battling the Black Bloc anarchists. I call them in a column the cancer of the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. These are the groups that get their name because they move in a group in en masse, dressed in black, cover their faces, carry out acts of petty vandalism, taunt the police, and I think this is deeply destructive to this movement, because I think the power of the Occupy movement is that it really did resonate with the 99%, that it articulated something that not only the poor, the working class, but even the middle class is experiencing, and that is our reconfiguration into a kind of neo-feudal society where you have a rapacious oligarchic elite. I mean, the head of Walmart makes $11,000 an hour, and then you have people struggling on $7.25 an hour, working two and three jobs, being pushed out of their homes, 6 million people losing their homes. But I think it has to remain nonviolent if it is going to bring in, as it has done, the mainstream. And this article on Monday comes from a conversation with Ralph Nader.
Right. About the minimum wage that you just referenced.
Yes. And Nader, and I think correctly, thinks that the movement can build broad popular support. Of course, the unions would get behind it. The California Nurses Association, which has been one of the most courageous and vocal unions in the country on this issue, La Raza, the NAACP. I mean, and of course, it's just a matter of fairness, because it's not been indexed. In real terms, those living on minimum wage or close to minimum wage have seen their salaries stagnate or decline. I think it has a potential to resonate across the country. And we know from opinion polls roughly 70% of Americans support raising the minimum wage to about $10 an hour.
A lot of political movement, even in the middle class and the working class in this country, though, has been fueled by people who frame the argument and pit people against each other. For instance, we just had a talk about pension reform in San Diego County, and the argument could be made that the idea of saying public sector workers should not get guaranteed pensions anymore is pitting public sector workers against private sector workers who basically have no retirement pension plans anymore. And yet, it's a very popular argument. People say, yes, why should I be working for someone who doesn't, who gets a pension? Why should I be paying that pension for that person?
It's an insidious argument, and it's asking the wrong question. The question is, what happened to our society? Why aren't people in the private sector, as they once did, as steelworkers did, and I come out of the working class, relatives who could make $50 an hour, who had medical benefits, who had pensions, who could, on that salary, none of them got rich, of course, but they could support a family, send their kids to college, buy a small house. What happened to that? That's the question. And by these corporate systems of information have reframed it in the same way that before the rise of the Occupy movement, we talked about a deficit crisis. They frame the language by which we discuss it. We don't have a deficit crisis. We have a revenue crisis. And much of our revenue crisis comes from the fact that large corporations don't pay taxes. General Electric, Bank of America, they don't pay an income tax. They haven't for years. And these unbelievable bonus packages and CEO salaries in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, it's utterly obscene. And I think that as we have seen a consolidation of the media into the hands of roughly six corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Disney. As Dorothy Parker used to say about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range of acting, the discussion ranges goes from A to B. And that's the problem, that we're not asking the right question. So the last readout of unionized labor in this country is largely public sector.
You, in your writings and in some of the speeches that I've heard you give on YouTube, are very critical of President Obama. You say many people who voted for him are deeply disappointed. Can you explain that?
Well, I didn't support Obama, and I think it's because a close examination of the systems of power illustrate, as probably our greatest living political philosopher Sheldon Wolin has pointed out, that we exist under a system that's best described as inverted totalitarianism. And by that he doesn't mean classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in classical totalitarian regimes, you have a reactionary or a revolutionary party overthrowing a structure and replacing it. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized all of the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. And we see that in one piece of legislation after another, all of which are written by corporate lobbyists, Obamacare being a good way to start. This is just the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, $400 billion in subsidies. One of the first things the White House did after the passage of the bill was hand out exemptions because these insurance companies do not want to care for chronically ill children. I mean, I come out of seminary. I think of it in moral terms. We live in a nation where it is now legally permissible for corporations to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. And Obama is as craven to these interests as was George W. Bush. I mean, he has broken just about every campaign promise he made, including, by the way, the promise to raise the minimum wage to $9.50 by 2011. He has now using super PACs, which he said he would never do, to fund his campaign. He has done nothing to restrain the criminal activity of the speculator class on Wall Street. And in the 17th century, financial speculation was a crime. Speculators were hung. And today they control, they dominate our economy, and they run our political space. And I think that the Democratic Party is as broken as the Republican Party.
So where is one to go politically?
To civil disobedience. And I think that's the only way to put pressure on the centers of power. But the question is whether they get the numbers. If you continue to have incidents, as we saw in Oakland, where you have these hooligans dressed in black, breaking coffee shop windows and desecrating public property and burning flags, well, then we're finished. And, you know, frankly, just as the state has employed tremendous resources externally to remove these Occupy encampments, I have no doubt that they are working internally to destroy them. And for me, violence and vandalism, disrespect, is the fastest way to alienate the Occupy movement from the mainstream, and I've got to believe that's what they want to do.
And we're now going to start the main part of our show looking at direct action movements of the 20th century. And this is an interview from episode 573 of Black Op Radio from April this year. Now, Jim Douglas, remember, we last heard in episode 517 speaking about JFK and the Unspeakable.
Today we're going to speak about the latest book, which is Gandhi and the Unspeakable, his final experiment with truth. To start the topic off, can you give us a brief background of what got you into this topic? And I meant writing about it.
Yes, I've been absorbed with Gandhi since I was a student at Santa Clara University in the 1950s. And Gandhi was my way into understanding Jesus. And I wrote about the nonviolence of Jesus for a number of years, especially through the understanding of Gandhi, and also the process by which Gandhi understood his own life and his mission to the world, what he called experiments with truth, is the way I've tried to write and, for that matter, live after learning it from Gandhi by reading his autobiography many years ago. So Gandhi has been with me for a long time, but specifically in relation to this book, I was working on the book following up the JFK one that you mentioned, JFK and the Unspeakable. I was working on its successor, which is Martin Malcolm and the Unspeakable, on Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and their assassinations. But for the first chapter, I decided to write about Gandhi because it seemed that he was a good lead-in to Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And I learned that Gandhi's assassination involved some of the same elements that are basic to all of those four key assassinations of the 60s. So I began to write at greater length on it, and eventually it became its own book. So I didn't plan to write a book about Gandhi, although he's been in my mind and heart for many, many years, but because of the assassinations of the four, Martin, Malcolm, JFK, and RFK, I got led into Gandhi.
Now, the book isn't as big as the previous one, but yes. I recommend it. So to listeners of Black Op Radio, I recommend it. And if you know, if James Douglas has put in the pen to paper, it's worth reading. So a couple of things that stood out was I did not know much about Gandhi, except that I thought he was just widely respected everywhere. And I come against this parallel about John F. Kennedy that I thought, well, he was such a great man. Everyone loved him. And the further I get into it, I find he's surrounded by enemies. And the same thing here happens, that as I get into that, that he is actually enemies on every side. It's hard for him to continue with this nonviolence where that's what's happening. Yeah. Now, I guess I should back up. I had no idea that his experiment, as it were, started in South Africa.
Yes.
And why don't we give listeners just a little background to that? Because I just thought it was in India the whole time with England, but it wasn't.
Well, Gandhi went to South Africa because he was such a failure in India as a lawyer. That was his profession. When he returned from England, he was trained as a lawyer. And he was offered a position in South Africa at a point where he wanted to, in a sense, start all over again because he had not done very well in India, to put it mildly. He just did not succeed as a lawyer. And he then accepted a position in South Africa, and in the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century, he was, first of all, a lawyer and then a person who was representing the entire Indian community in South Africa as he tried to overcome their suppression by the government, which was a kind of prophetic anticipation of what the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela would do in the 20th century in overcoming apartheid. And they were drawing on the example of Gandhi in the 90s and the first part of the 20th century. Mandela says that explicitly, as I cite him in the book. Gandhi established a pattern of nonviolent resistance through his the first 20-plus years of his career as an activist, and that all occurred in South Africa.
It's an interesting background, and I was also pleasantly surprised doing some research to find quite a bit of videos on this on YouTube, that if people, you know, once they get your book and go through it, there is both sides of the story, and there's quite a bit on YouTube as well.
Yes. Well, I encourage everybody to learn as much as they can about Gandhi, because not only his assassination, which I wrote specifically about, but his vision of nonviolent transformation of the world is critical to all of us, and especially at this moment in history when everything is coming apart or coming together, depending on whether you're looking at the overall political process in this country especially, or whether you're looking at nonviolent movements around the globe. Those are the downs and the ups of this situation we're living in it right now. And the way Dr. Martin Luther King put it was nonviolence or non-existence, which was a drawing on the vision of Gandhi, who said that many times in many ways. And his alternative, which he called Satyagraha, truth force, which is equivalent to love force and soul force, he said that was the most powerful force in the universe. I think he's right. And it's a force that we can experiment with, as he did, and as Dr. King did, and as Nelson Mandela did in other ways in South Africa. And it's a force that can change this world in a way that will allow us not only to survive, but to thrive together in peace and justice.
Right, truth. Now, his first name was Mohandas, but he was called Mahatma, the great soul.
Yes.
So in one way, he was respected by people who met him. As a matter of fact, you recount a few stories of would-be assassins that had come up to do him in, and after 5 or 10 minutes of him just talking to him, he was able to dissuade the person. And in fact, I think there's one anecdote there that when someone had tried to assassinate him, rather than charging him, he invited the guy to live with him for a week. He
said, that was the man who actually did assassinate him. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's what he's saying. If you had a chance to have dinner with me and live with me for a week, I might change your mind completely. But unfortunately, that didn't happen.
The man refused, and that man was Nathuram Godse, who was the man who pulled the trigger on him and killed him on January 30th, 1948. And that incident occurred several years before in what was an earlier effort to kill him. And he offered Godse a week with Gandhi, which almost anybody else in the world would have jumped at. But Godse knew in his heart that if he did that, he might not be able to carry out the mission that he had been basically assigned by his teacher, a man named Savarkar.
So let's talk about him just a little bit, because this is where the parallels are, that it's an orchestrated effort to remove someone. Although it appears as if there's a lone assassin, and that's what history or the press would like you to take out of it, you recognize different groups vying for power. Someone is in their opposition, and they have someone removed. And this is the parallel from what you might say were great leaders, that finally they came up against a power that said, we've had enough of this guy, he's got to be removed.
Yes, the man who was the mastermind of Gandhi's assassination, Vinayak Damodar Savarkar, is a man that Gandhi had known for many, many years. He had met him on a trip from South Africa to England in 1906, and then on a second trip to England in 1909, he saw him again. And in the 1909 trip to England, Gandhi arrived just after an assassination had occurred in London. It was the assassination of a man who was the British member of the government who was in charge of the affairs of state in India. So it was a high-level assassination, and was carried out by an Indian student, a man named Dhingra. The man who was killed, Sir William Curzon Wiley, the political aide to the Secretary of State for India, he was shot to death at a very prominent gathering of primary movers of Indian policy. Of course, this was imperial policy while India was part of the British Empire. And the assassin, Madanlal Dhingra, who was an engineering student, he knew the man that he killed, William Curzon Wiley. Wiley, the political aide to the Secretary of State, was a friend of his family in India. And even more than that, his father had basically assigned Wiley, asked Wiley, this prominent British politician, to look after his son in London while he was studying there. But the assassin, Dhingra, came under the influence of Savarkar at a place called the India House, where Indian students gathered and lived in London while they were there studying. And virtually all of them had become radicalized in a violent sense, seeing assassination in particular as the way to overcome the British government. And Savarkar had told Dhingra, who came under his influence, to carry out an assassination by killing this man Wiley, and he did, at a gathering of the National Indian Association in the heart of London, where they were having a dinner for all the major politicians. And Dhingra came up and shot Wiley when Wiley thought he was going to shake his hand. When Gandhi arrived about 3 days later, 4 days later in London, this was on the front page of every newspaper. It was the center of political controversy and a great deal of attitude deepening on the part of both the Indian community, many of whom cited, saying this was justifiable, and the British community, which was shocked and offended, of course, by the assassination. Savarkar was behind it. The effect of it was that Dhingra was executed. Savarkar even wrote the statement that Dhingra used to explain his assassination, but he did so without revealing his own involvement, Savarkar did, and Dhingra went to his death denying that Savarkar had anything to do with it, although a number of people assumed the opposite was the case. So that was the beginning, as Gandhi confronted that issue in London, the beginning of Gandhi's tension with Savarkar, because Gandhi denounced both the assassination, although he understood that Dhingra was being moved by somebody else, and he denounced anybody who was doing that moving, and he knew it was probably Savarkar.
You go on to mention that he did come under the scrutiny of the British justice system when they were able to trace a revolver back to him.
Yes. That was on another assassination. Savarkar was involved in more than one, many of them. And when there was an assassination in India, Savarkar had sent a pistol for that and had been writing to and influencing the people who carried out that assassination. And it was in relation to that that the British government arrested Savarkar and sent him back to India to be tried, where he was sentenced to a 50-year sentence and put into a very severe prison off the coast of India in the Andaman Islands. And so Savarkar's career continued from that prison toward the point where he would eventually be behind the assassination of Gandhi.
Now, I think one problem that critics have with Gandhi is that the British were so ruthless on Indian people, and there was shootings, executions, all sorts of things that they felt that you could not just peacefully resist this. You had to mount some kind of opposition.
Right.
And these are the two heads, Savarkar and Gandhi, the 280 degrees apart from each other.
Yes.
Yet I'm still surprised that Gandhi seemed as a threat. You would have thought that if his opposition to something was peaceful, that he wouldn't pose any threat anyway. Because what would he do? He would just nonviolently resist your idea.
That's true. But the British learned, as did all of Gandhi's enemies, that He was a force to be reckoned with, and I emphasize force, as Gandhi himself did. Gandhi's concept, his vision, his understanding of nonviolence was not a non. It was truth. Truth force, love force, soul force, satyagraha. That's exactly what the word means. Satya is the word for truth or being, the basis for truth. And agraha is holding on to the truth. It's a kind of force. It is a force. And Gandhi said it was not only a force, it was the force, far more powerful than any force that the British Empire could bring against the people of India, if the people of India only realized that power that they had, which was the power of nonviolent resistance. When Gandhi moved from South Africa, where he had a very powerful campaign that overcame several laws that the government there had used to press Indians, when he moved back to India in the mid-teens, 1915, and when he began then to mount a campaign against the empire as such, then the British began to see especially how powerful that force was that Gandhi was exploring in. And he, by mobilizing through his own example and through his attitude toward the British, which combined both respect, dialogue, and love in terms of not so much affection as seeing the presence of God, which he called Rama, seeing the presence of Rama in every British official, in every British person. He saw that at the same time as he said, we must love and respect our oppressors at the same time as we nonviolently resist them. Non-cooperation with evil is as much a duty as cooperation with good. That was his principle. But the nonviolent part of it was both in the non-cooperation with the laws that were oppressing them and the Indians' respect and dialogue and love for the people. Now, that is an incredible combination, and it's the very heart of Gandhi's satyagraha, and it is truly a force because it disarms in both ways. It disarms both because the people are no longer cooperating with their own oppression, and it disarms, on the other hand, because they are disarming their enemies by not hitting them back. They may be hit themselves, but they're not going to hit back. And in scene after scene in India, in very extraordinary ways, the Indian people, with Gandhi's guidance and inspiration, resisted the British Empire without retaliating against the overwhelming violence that you were just citing.
You know, I'm surprised at how many times he was arrested and jailed that you would think that this sounds good, but you have to do something, and I don't know what the answer is, but I'm just thinking that if a violent revolution is not the answer, absolutely sitting down and doing nothing seems to take too long. You had an anecdote about, I'm not sure if it was the police chief, forgive me for not knowing the guy's name, but he was briefing Winston Churchill, and he was telling, listen, you know, this Gandhi is a real religious man. He has God on his side, and people will follow him. And Churchill seemed to just chuckle at that and say, well, who is this guy? You know, he's not going to be any problem. But that's the thing, that in India there was these battling religions, different sects, and then Pakistan separating, all these different things going on, that it almost seems that the British Empire was in one way a stabilizing force. If they were just to up and leave, it could be just as disastrous as having them there. You know, no one wanted them there, but yet if they just left, there would be this revolution, power shifting, you know, what religion was going to try to make a power grab. It's a complicated issue.
Yes, it's a complicated issue in so many ways, as are all of our issues today. In another Oh, here comes a train. As you know, Len, I'm right next to the railroad tracks, so here in Birmingham, Alabama. But in ways, both a complicating issue, and at the other side, it's simple. It's simple in the sense that Gandhi saw that the empire was in the hearts and souls of the people they were oppressing. They were dependent upon, the empire was dependent upon the cooperation of hundreds of millions of people, the people of India. And if those people, Gandhi realized, could realize that they had each within himself or herself the power to say no and didn't have to fear the British officials and the British power, then the British Empire was itself powerless. It's a very simple concept. Any person, anywhere in the world, if he or she can overcome their fear of authority, I'm talking about especially illegitimate authority, which is all over the place, and which is the factor that is necessary for an empire to maintain its power, if that can be overcome on the part of the people who are being oppressed, in this case India, then the empire has no power. Gandhi understood that through his experience in South Africa from the very beginning, when he himself was thrown off a train in South Africa because he was not a white man, because he was a person of color, and because a man objected to his presence in the same compartment as Gandhi. Gandhi was thrown off a train in South Africa, and Gandhi, as this new lawyer in this country where he was going to try to establish a practice of law, he had to decide, how am I going to respond to this? Am I going to go along with it, as many of the Indian people there were doing already, in order to survive? Or, Gandhi thought, am I going to refuse to cooperate with this inhuman way I have been treated? He decided on the latter. And for him to refuse to cooperate with it, he realized he had to work with a lot of other people so that they could all refuse to cooperate with it. And that became his experiment with truth, the truth of satyagraha, the force of truth of saying no to that oppression and drawing upon a far deeper power, which was a power both of non-cooperation and love. He was not going to retaliate against his oppressor with force. He was simply going to say no. And if he and his fellow Indians could do that, the oppressor had no power, because they were willing to say no, no matter what the oppressor did, no matter what the empire did when he went to India, no matter whether it meant imprisonment, whether it meant all kinds of brutality, or whether it meant dying. They were willing to accept those consequences rather than cooperate. In other words, they left fear behind. And once they left fear behind, after the example of Gandhi, the oppressor had no power whatsoever. And that was freedom right there. The oppressor could say, you can't be free. We're not going to give you freedom. They were already free. They were already free. When they said goodbye to fear, they were already free.
Well, that's optimistic in the long term, because, as we know, he was jailed so many times. So
yes,
although that was the goal, it's hard to say, unless everyone sat down and, for instance, if everyone refused to buy a train ticket, or like in America where they refused to ride the buses and they started walking to work.
Exactly.
So that there's a long term, but in the short term, people were arrested, or it reminds me maybe like of Jesse Ventura when he said, "I'm not going through these scanners and these things at the airports now. I'm just refusing to fly."
Yeah.
But unless everyone refuses to fly, it doesn't change anything. And you know, that's a perfect example of nonviolent opposition. Just stop buying into that program. Yet I can see the opposition saying that, I'm not making a case for it, but I can see it just seems to be such a long-term thing when you say to your oppressors, when they say, we're charging you tax on salt, and you say, we get our salt here, why should it go to England and come back to us, right?
Yeah.
We can get it here for free. Why should we pay tax on that? And we're just not going to use your salt anymore, right? So that's the long-term goal. But his opposition was claiming that the brutality of the empire required something. And it seemed to me he took as many attacks and beatings, and you mentioned his final assassination was not from the British government, but from his opposition. They wanted swifter action, and it seemed that he was such a problem that they had to do him in. And somehow that's the final irony there, because it wasn't the British Empire that had him assassinated.
That's right. It wasn't the British Empire that had him assassinated, but in a sense it was the British Empire that set up his assassination. It was in the context of the partition of India and Pakistan, in which Gandhi was killed, and the British Empire was responsible for that partition. They were dividing through their entire dominance of India. Their policy was, just as the Roman Empire earlier did, was to divide in order to rule. And this specific division that they emphasized, the British did, was that between Muslims and Hindus, which eventually resulted in the creation of the country of Pakistan rather than in one united India. And in that process, which continued right up to the moment when India was granted its freedom, which was simultaneously the creation of Pakistan, Gandhi was doing everything he could to keep Muslims and Hindus together, as he had successfully done in South Africa, where the Muslim community had actually brought him over there and with whom he was very close. In India, he didn't succeed in that. He did everything he could to overcome the British Empire's policy of dividing and ruling, but he didn't succeed in that. There were very prominent powers that worked against it, beginning with London and including, of course, Savarkar and the Hindutva movement. The Hindutva movement was a movement of Hindu nationalists who thought that to be deeply Hindu meant to be anti-Muslim, because there was something inherent in Hinduism and Islam that made them totally irreconcilable. That was the vision that Savarkar created while he was in prison under the British. Savarkar became a cooperator in prison with the British Empire in order to achieve his own release. And he then began the Hindutva movement, which worked right into and basically reinforced the British policy of dividing Hindus and Muslims. So Savarkar, by insisting on a very militant nationalistic Hinduism, totally opposite to Gandhi's vision, he helped promote the British divide and rule policy and continued that vision of Hindutva not only up to Gandhi's assassination, which was the motivating factor behind it, but far beyond it, to the point where at the present in India, the legacy of Gandhi is continuing in the Hindutva movement and in fact achieved power over the rest of the country at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of this century. The Hindutva movement became the ruling power in India at that time. It isn't right now, but in different parts of India, it is dominant. So Savarkar's killing through Godse of Gandhi has created a legacy of division between Muslims and Hindus that has continued to this very day. The assassination of Gandhi is critical to understanding the situation in India today, and for that matter, the analogous conflict between Christians and certain Muslims that underlies the policies of the U.S. government today.
Now, you mentioned South Africa a little bit, and that's where he kind of got this effort of a walkout with minors and Indian people having to have these fingerprint and registrations. And he got that to work with some success, as you say. So when he went back to India, he tried to enact lessons learned from there. How successful do you think he was in India? I mean, it's years later now, so, you know, people speak of him as a legend. But
well, he in relation to India today, if you judged Gandhi by where India is today, one would say he was, to a very large degree, unsuccessful, although there are profound ways in which India wouldn't even exist as a country, much less as a democratic government or democratic country if Gandhi had not worked there. So it's a mixed legacy, but one has to remember that the Congress Party and the man who became Gandhi's successor in relation to the Indian government, Nehru, had very different attitudes than Gandhi himself did when they took power. And they had agreed, in essence, to the partition of India and Pakistan. They had agreed to the vision of two separate countries. Gandhi never agreed to that, but they did. And as a result of that, and as a result of Nehru also accepting the possibility, I say the possibility, of India becoming a nuclear power, I tell that story in the book, his daughter, then Mrs. Gandhi, who had no relation, incidentally, to Mohandas Gandhi, but her name was Gandhi, last name, Indira Gandhi. She then exploded the first nuclear weapon and development of India as a nuclear power. So that's a legacy that is totally opposed to Gandhi, and that is nevertheless pursued by people who knew Gandhi and went the opposite direction that he did in the final stages of India becoming independent. It's a complex process. Gandhi stood for unity between Hindus and Muslims. He stood for one India, not a division of two countries. He stood for nonviolence, not the creation of nuclear weapons as a way to defend India, as Nehru chose and Indira Gandhi chose. He stood for the opposite of the legacy that has put India in the wrong direction in so many ways.
In your research, do you have something that maybe stands out was the most surprising aspect of Gandhi that you didn't know that you can share right now?
Well, it's not like I didn't know the dimensions of Gandhi. I knew those fairly well. I've studied Gandhi all my life. But I didn't know the depth of his willingness to see through the eyes of his enemies, the depth of his willingness to see through the eyes of his enemies. I'll give a specific example. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was the main force behind the creation of Pakistan, a great politician, he and Gandhi knew each other extremely well. He was, in a sense, the foremost proponent of the vision that would dismantle Gandhi's idea of Muslims and Hindus creating a united India as an example to the rest of the world. Jinnah just held out to the end and successfully for a specifically Muslim country, Pakistan. And at the end, when Gandhi, prior to the creation of Pakistan and the freeing of India from the British Empire, when Gandhi met with Lord Mountbatten, who was engineering that process, he proposed as a way of keeping India together and not having to have two separate countries, and which resulted, of course, in a partition that resulted in mutual genocide, Muslims murdering Hindus, Hindus murdering Muslims as they moved back and forth. All the Muslims, or a huge number of them, moving in the direction of Pakistan, and the Hindus moving out of what was becoming Pakistan into India. When that was happening, beginning or on the verge of happening, Gandhi proposed to Lord Mountbatten, who was overseeing the process of a new Pakistan and a freeing of India, that in order to avoid all of that occurring, that he support, Mountbatten and the British Empire support, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Gandhi's major enemy in all of this, becoming the head of the government of India. Gandhi realized that Jinnah would back away from Pakistan if he could become even more powerful as the head of the government of India. So Gandhi said in his quiet negotiations with Mountbatten, appoint Jinnah, propose Jinnah be the head of the government and then see what resulted from that. And he thought, and I think rightly, as other people have thought since, that would forego Pakistan, and Jinnah would accept even greater power by becoming the ruler of India. Of course, he'd have a Congress party to be, deal with, and he'd have a couple of hundred million other people, which would include a large number of Hindus to deal with. But with Gandhi's support, as he would have, and with the mixture of both Muslims and Hindus, he could have even greater power. That didn't happen. Mountbatten didn't go for it, and especially Nehru didn't go for it, who would then not become the Prime Minister of India. And the Congress Party didn't go for it because they wouldn't have been quite so powerful, because Jinnah would be the head of the government. But what I'm saying is that Gandhi saw through the eyes of his opponent. He saw both his strengths and his weaknesses. He saw he was a great politician. He saw that he could be a good ruler of India if he ruled in a united country of both Hindus and Muslims, as well as Sikhs, Christians, and everybody else. He saw something that nobody would have seen if they just saw Jinnah as the enemy. He saw Jinnah as his brother. He saw Jinnah as a great politician. Every time you see him in a picture with Jinnah, he's got his arms around him and hugging him and smiling. And he just always saw through the eyes of the enemy. And in that instance, he saw a way of transformation through the eyes of his enemy. And unfortunately, those closest to him, in a deeper sense, the Congress Party authorities couldn't go with it.
Yeah, that is amazing. Still, after I read the book, it leaves you this question of, when you know an empire is being a brutal, oppressive force,
yes,
how do you try to take their point of view and use it to your advantage and politely tell them that, like you mentioned, he came up with this truth. Here's the truth. You should not take advantage of people the way you have been doing. Yet this empire, you know, it seems like it's just like a monolith, something that just can't stop, and you're asking it to stop on the betterment of mankind. And although like you mentioned, India would not be the same, and for an example, Gandhi seems to have at least some success, and let's just say it was halfway, you know, the British Empire did fold, and they gave India, it became independent. The only downside is creating Pakistan at the same time, and now this bitter rivalry at the border there between those two, which is more religious than almost anything else. I mean, there's problems in India anyway with Indira Gandhi and her problems with the Punjab and Sikhs and their own internal problems.
Well, empires didn't end with the British Empire. We've got one right now, the one I'm living in the middle of in Birmingham, Alabama. The United States Empire, and the process of overcoming an empire that I believe in, that following Gandhi and a number of other visionaries of nonviolence, is again one of non-cooperation with evil, which means you have to be willing to non-cooperate, for example, in the United States with military power that is everywhere in our lives. Certainly it means non-cooperating with the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, the war in Pakistan, namely the assassination teams that go in there constantly, just as they do in Afghanistan. Every night there are many assassination teams that go into both countries to kill those who are assumed to be on the other side, quote-unquote. One has to oppose this with one's whole life. That means nonviolent resistance. It means not paying taxes to the United States government. It means doing acts of nonviolent civil disobedience in other ways in the U.S. It means going to jail, just as Gandhi did in India. It means refusing jobs that are in any way complicit with that kind of military power. It takes tens of millions of people, really hundreds of millions, at this point, to carry out the policies that our current empire is carrying out in countries all over the world. So unless one's willing to go those lengths of nonviolence, of satyagraha, of truth force, love force, soul force, in the United States of America, there's going to be a continuation. There will be a continuation of those policies, the war in Afghanistan. It isn't enough to wait until there's a presidential candidate who seems to be going in a different direction. A lot of people felt that with Barack Obama. Unfortunately, that doesn't work by just waiting for one person to save us. Well, we know the story of Kennedy. John F. Kennedy did try to move in that opposite direction, and precisely for that reason, he was assassinated. That's the whole story of JFK's assassination. If Barack Obama were to move in that direction, he would stand in the shoes of Kennedy, both in a positive way and with consequences that would threaten his life. He knows that. He's not a man without intelligence. He's an extremely brilliant man. So unless the people of the country, whether it be Kennedy's context or Barack Obama's context, unless the people of the country take a stand where we are willing to go as far in nonviolence as, say, for example, U.S. policies are willing to go in terms of the troops with violence, the troops have to give up their lives or risk their lives in order to carry out the violent objectives of war. In nonviolence, to carry out the vision of peace, we have to be willing to give our lives. If the troops are willing to do that, we better be willing to do that in a process that goes in a different direction. So, as Gandhi said, widen the prison gates. Widen the prison gates. He said that with a smile, and he walked into those prisons, as did hundreds of thousands of Indian people as a result of the Salt March, for example. Over 100,000 were jailed. Many more were willing to go to jail as a result of the Salt March. When we begin to reach that point in the USA and in the world where we are all going to be moving in that direction, this world is going to change. It is going to change in a profoundly nonviolent way.
When you started discussing that, it made me think about how America swiftly went into Libya and called for action, and yet in Syria, yeah, nothing going on, and you would think that you couldn't even compare the two.
Well, Syria and Libya are both situations in which there were oppressive governments, but there are other factors involved, for example, oil, and there are factors of politics which made it more expedient for the U.S. to intervene in Libya than in Syria. So,
yeah, they have oil and gold and whatnot, right?
And the spring in the Arab countries, the Arab Spring, as they call it, is basically one of nonviolent resistance right across the board. There is profound nonviolent resistance in all of those countries. And the process of the U.S. intervening in Libya changed the dynamic at a critical point. You know, nonviolence is a process which requires enormous patience. It requires enormous commitment to a willingness to undergo suffering rather than killing. And that process was possible in Libya as it is possible in Syria. And when it gets mixed in with violence, that's when it becomes more problematic. And the Arab Spring was moving and still is moving, I think, especially in terms of Palestinians who have today a deep commitment to nonviolence, the Palestinian movement. I think that's the much more hopeful direction than the U.S. intervention anywhere, because as soon as the U.S. begins to intervene, then we have a very, very mixed process.
Now, you touched on something that I did want to bring up. It's Gandhi's idea of freedom through suffering. Maybe can you discuss this? Because this is an idea that he seems to have shaped.
He said, as Dr. King has said since then, and as many other people have said, that suffering can be redemptive. And that means suffering in nonviolent resistance out of love for both freedom and our brothers and sisters in the struggle and the enemy. Suffering in all of those directions can be redemptive, will be redemptive. Rather than inflicting suffering on someone else in order to force them to do what we want to do, which is the process of war, not only suffering, but suffering to death, by turning that around and being willing to accept suffering while at the same time being unwilling to accept oppression, one can become free in the process. That is the genius of Gandhi. It's the genius of King. It goes back to the teachings of Jesus, of Buddha, and of every major religion in the world, without exception, including Islam, of course. Gandhi's greatest ally in the movement of freedom for India was Abdul Ghaffar Khan, who was a Muslim, and who then, when Pakistan was partitioned from India, went to jail in both Pakistan and across the border in Afghanistan for most of the rest of his life. And Abdul Ghaffar Khan taught the redemptive power of suffering based on the Quran. So we're not just talking Christian language here, we're talking Muslim language from the standpoint of those who, out of Islam, draw exactly the same vision of nonviolent transformation for the world by suffering for justice and peace rather than killing for justice and peace. And, of course, in war, that's part of the story, too. That's why we honor soldiers. Hopefully, we don't honor them because they're going around killing other people. We honor them because they're willing to accept suffering in the process. So the government tries to focus on that without saying the obvious, that their real reason is to kill. It's not simply to suffer for the truth. So we draw out of the major gallantry of war the same lesson that we draw out of the heart of nonviolent campaigns. When you're willing to suffer and die for the truth, you are a transforming power. And that's what Gandhi realized without connecting it with killing. He pushed killing to the side and said, well, we'll be willing to suffer, but we're going to suffer out of love, not out of vengeance. We're going to suffer out of respect, not out of retaliation, not out of disrespect. And we're going to transform the world in that way. And that process is ongoing, and it's happening right now.
Do you feel there's anyone following in Gandhi's shoes that is leading this idea of truth?
Yes, they're not so well known as Gandhi. But the woman in what used to be called Burma and should still be called Burma, I can't pronounce her name properly, but she was just elected yesterday to the parliament, and she is a leader in that. In the United States of America, a woman named Kathy Kelly, who lives in Chicago and who leads delegations regularly to Afghanistan and who has been arrested many, many times in resistance to the U.S. government policies in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and in U.S. nuclear weapons policies, she's an example of a great leader today. But we don't have to look to the heights. We can look to the depths of all of us. Any of us can become leaders in this process simply by saying no to oppression and war and yes to freedom, regardless of the consequences. And I mean regardless of suffering in our own lives. In fact, we need to embrace that suffering, and when we do, and see that it can be a way of redemption, then everything opens up. Everything opens up.
And I guess in this suffering, boycott would be one of the avenues where you stop using something that you previously did. So, like, for instance, if you say, I'm going to object to the airport screening, I'm just going to refuse to fly.
Yes, that would be an example. Or boycotting any product that's associated with a particular policy or with a particular way of oppression. It's the boycott of Myanmar and the support of the freedom movement there that has resulted in a turnaround in that country. It was a boycott of products from South Africa and the divesting of investment in South Africa that resulted hugely in the freedom of that country. So non-cooperation with evil is as much a duty as cooperation with good, as Gandhi said. And if we follow that out specifically by what we eat, what we drink, how we live, then we can be free and people everywhere can become free.